Uncharted Territory, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. An administration in disarray. Reports of a resistance from within. An unpredictable president. We asked two veteran diplomats who've served under both Republican and Democratic presidents what they make of it all.
I've never seen anything like this before because there's never been anything like this before in our modern history. This is new and uncharted ground. It is deeply unsettling.
I think that President Trump is going to go down as one of the weakest and most misguided presidents we've had on international policy.
And later, we check in with students who left Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria to study on the U.S. mainland. Almost a year later, some have returned home and some haven't. Those stories and much more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's Friday, and what a week it's been in the news. The storyline in Washington, of course, has been all about the perception of dysfunction at the White House. First, veteran journalist Bob Woodward's new book made a splash, and it's not even on the shelves yet. Then came the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, written by someone described as a senior official in the Trump administration. It used words like impulsiveness, ill-informed, and amorality to describe the president. At a campaign rally last night in Montana, Donald Trump called on the Times to reveal the author's identity.
For the sake of our national security, the New York Times should publish his name at once. I think their reporters should go and investigate who it is. That would actually be a good scoop. That would be a good scoop. Unelected deep state operatives who defy the voters to push their own secret agendas are truly a threat to democracy itself.
Trump told his supporters to get out and vote in November, or else his political enemies would try to impeach him. For their part, the Democrats saw one of their most prominent national figures take the stage today.
In 2 months, we have the chance, not the certainty, but the chance, to restore some semblance of sanity to our politics.
Speaking in the University of Illinois, Barack Obama delivered an unvarnished rebuke of the Trump presidency.
And by the way, the claim that everything will turn out okay because there are people inside the White House who secretly aren't following the president's orders, that is not a check. I'm being serious here. That's not how our democracy is supposed to work. These people aren't elected. They're not accountable. They're not doing us a service by actively promoting 90% of the crazy stuff that's coming out of this White House and then saying, don't worry, we're preventing the other 10%.
No matter where you might stand along our current political divide, there's a real potential downside to all this talk about dysfunction in the White House. So here's the question. Could it have an impact on the work of U.S. diplomacy? To dig into that, we turn to two career diplomats. Ryan Crocker served as a U.S. ambassador under both Republican and Democratic presidents, including Iraq under George W. Bush and Afghanistan under Barack Obama. Nick Burns was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and U.S. Ambassador to NATO under President George W. Bush. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to Greece under President Bill Clinton. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get down to it now. Did either of you ever find yourself in the position of representing an administration where senior members of that administration appeared to have so little confidence in the chief executive? Ambassador Burns, let's start with you.
No, I didn't. I served in every administration from President Jimmy Carter to the Obama years. And, you know, it's inevitable that career people are going to disagree with one decision or another. That makes sense. That happens. But I've never encountered a situation where there was so much distrust or even disdain of the president himself, of his character, of his inconsistency, of his lack of knowledge, of his lack of preparation. And you're hearing that in the books that are just coming out, the Woodward book. You saw some of that in this extraordinary op-ed in the New York Times, and it's troubling.
How about you, Ambassador Crocker?
Well, Nick is right. I served 6 times as ambassador, 3 times for Republican administrations, 3 times for Democratic. I've never seen anything like this before because there's never been anything like this before in our modern history. This is new and uncharted ground. It is deeply unsettling for the reasons that Nick cites, but there are other elements to it as well. An unnamed senior official publishes an op-ed in which he or she is effectively saying, we're here to be sure the president doesn't do something really bad. Well, that's kind of getting at the core of our institutions and values. Are we saying here that the Secretary of Defense, for example, is purely hypothetical, would countermand an order from the Commander-in-Chief, and we should feel good about that? I'm not sure I do. This is getting at, again, our core ethos as Americans.
Ambassador Burns, do you think that anonymous op-ed that we're just talking about will have any impact on how our allies and rivals around the world work with the U.S.?
I think it'll add to the concerns. I mean, there's a palpable concern. You see it and you feel it when you talk to other officials around the world. They worry about the character of the president. They worry about the amorality, that was the word used in the op-ed, of the president. They worry very much about his inconsistency, saying one thing on one day and quite another on another. And I know in Europe, I was ambassador to NATO. I spent some time in Europe this summer. There's real anger over his consistent public criticism of Prime Minister Theresa May in Britain, of Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany, of Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. And the president has this tendency to be very supportive publicly and almost admiring of autocratic leaders like Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin and disdainful of democratic leaders. We've never had a president like this. I believe he's hurting the United States. He's hurting not just our image, but our power and influence in the world.
Ambassador Burns, when you were serving overseas as an ambassador, did you ever find yourself having to kind of correct the record to try to put the idea of America and what it stands for in a different light than the sitting president?
Well, Ryan and I have both been ambassadors and career diplomats in the field, and we owe our presidents 100% loyalty. And you always stand up for the president and the Secretary of State when you're an ambassador overseas. Sure, there are times when something's unclear about our policy. You try to make it transparent and clear. And if there's a misunderstanding, you try to resolve the misunderstanding. But you owe the president loyalty and trust. And if you can't give the president loyalty and trust, or if you have a significant disagreement on policy or on ethics, then you have the choice of resigning. I think what troubles a lot of people about the op-ed that was published in the New York Times is that if this person who wrote it, if he or she believes the president is not fit for office, that person should say that with their name attached to it.
Nick has, again, described this, I think, quite accurately. As an ambassador, it would be frankly unthinkable to say something along the lines of, oh, just disregard what the president said. Now, I have been part of conversations that had those elements in it, but it wasn't me saying it. It was an official of another country. I'd hate to think that we're now starting down that road ourselves.
If either of you were currently an ambassador in a particular country under President Trump, what would you be doing to represent your country?
Well, you know, career foreign service officers, career diplomats are just like career military officers. We serve the country. We serve the president that the country elects. We try our very best to uphold the values of the United States. And I think that you're seeing right now many, many career diplomats serving overseas, thousands of people doing their very best for the United States. The problem that we have, I think, of the Trump administration, it's almost as if we have two administrations. We have Donald Trump saying things and doing things that are contrary to our values and to our interests. You have another level of the government, members of the cabinet, who seem to be acquitting themselves in a very different way. So it's difficult for our career people in the field. Ultimately, they have to serve the president. And I think the president has dug a hole for the United States in many ways around the world. And it's up to our ambassadors, our generals, and other people representing us overseas to do the very best to maintain our influence in the world and the respect that other countries would have for us.
It's interesting you say sort of two governments. That's kind of what the op-ed writer, he or she, makes that point, too.
Well, you can't get around it because you have, for instance, Secretary Mattis and Secretary Pompeo being extremely supportive publicly and privately of NATO, and you have the president openly disdainful of NATO. You have the same situation going on trade issues. And so I think people are confused around the world. Other leaders are confused. The president has weakened our alliances. He's closing the doors to immigrants and refugees, which is not in the interest of the United States economically, but it's also not in the interest of the United States in terms of our values as a nation. We're an immigrant nation, and he's not standing up for democracy as it's under challenge in places like Western and Eastern Europe. He's actually siding with anti-democratic populists in places like Hungary and Poland. So in my view, he is repudiating what made America great over the last 70 years.
Ambassador Crocker, President Trump has described the New York Times op-ed as an act of treason. How do you describe it?
I certainly would not call that an act of treason. That is, frankly, a ridiculous assertion. But I think it is damaging, frankly. I wish that the New York Times had said, we will run this, but your name is going to have to be on it. When we start moving into the shadows here with anonymous senior individuals effectively saying they're working to block the president from within, that makes me distinctly uncomfortable. What Nick said, again, in my view, is exactly right. I would only add to that very good list that, broadly speaking, the president has turned our key relationships into purely transactional processes. He said as much with respect to Canada trade negotiation. You know, that's not how we have done our business in the past. We have valued our allies and treated them as allies, not as a pure apolitical transaction. That's deeply dangerous to not only our own national security, but to the world order, since we're still a leader in it. I don't think it gets any better, though, with anonymous writings such as this effectively saying it's going to be okay because we're going to take care of it inside, even if you don't know who I am. That, too, is inconsistent, I would say, with our own values.
Ambassador Burns, how do we rebuild trust with our allies?
I think it's going to take a while. I think you'll have to have a new president. We know enough about Donald Trump to know that he has no consistency of strategy. He appears to have no guiding internal principles that would be supportive of American values in the world. So it's important that Congress get involved. There's a separation of powers, but Congress has a role in foreign and defense policy. I certainly would like to see more congressional leadership on a bipartisan basis to do what Ryan and I have been arguing. Strengthen our allies, come back to sanity on trade, open up our country to lawful, legal immigration, take in refugees when we have to take in refugees to hold up our end of the international bargain. We've always done these things, and now we've stopped doing all of them. And I think that President Trump is going to go down as one of the weakest and most misguided presidents we've had on international policy.
I would agree that it will take another presidency to fully turn this around. That is why I believe it is very, very important that dealing with the immediate issue of the Trump presidency, we do not take steps that can undermine our core values, bring into question the authorities of the commander-in-chief, or anything of that nature. That may seem like something important to do now, but we've got to be very careful. We do not do things that are going to change our values and our structures over the long term. That could be used against any president.
Like what?
An op-ed like this. What if that had come out in the Obama administration? There were those clearly in government who were not fully supportive of his international policies. We've got to be very careful that an op-ed like this isn't seen as the new normal. That if you don't like the way the administration or the president is moving, you now have the precedent to be able to say, we're doing what we can inside to check him, and you don't even get to know my name.
Ambassador Nick Burns is now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador Ryan Crocker is diplomat in residence at Princeton University. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Coming up later in the show, the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan began 17 years ago. The toll has been enormous, first for Afghans, but also for American vets. We hear from C.J. Chivers, whose new book profiles six soldiers who served in Afghanistan and Iraq. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Brazil, the presidential election is just 1 month away, and the campaign has been, well, extraordinary. First of all, the front runner is in jail. That's former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. He's serving a 12-year prison sentence on corruption charges, and he's been barred from participating in the election. Then there's the situation with the far-right candidate, Jair Bolsonaro.
Vamos fuzilar a petralhada aqui do Acre.
Let me give you an image to go along with what you're hearing. That's Bolsonaro holding up a journalist's camera tripod and then pretending to use it as a machine gun. And the candidate is saying, we are going to execute our political opponents. By the way, Bolsonaro is sometimes described as Brazil's Donald Trump. That scene played out at a campaign rally last week. Now he's in the hospital, Bolsonaro was stabbed in the stomach yesterday. He survived, but doctors say a full recovery is going to take months. Michael Fox is a journalist based in Brazil. I asked him first about the attack on presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro.
So he was at a campaign rally in a town in Minas Gerais, about 125 miles north of Rio de Janeiro, so southern Brazil, eastern coast. He was being carried through the streets by his supporters when an assailant came up and stabbed him in the gut. He kind of bent over. According to local reports, the supporters beat the assailant, and then he was rushed to the hospital. Originally, they thought it was just a superficial wound, but upon further tests, they noticed he was hemorrhaging. It had hit a vein in his abdomen and two or three cuts to his intestines. So he underwent surgery, which he left last night around 7 p.m. in a stable condition, and that's the situation right now. This morning, he was brought to a hospital in Sao Paulo, where they're, like you said, he's expected to be there for roughly 7 to 10 days. But this is just a terrible, terrible turn of events in a campaign that is just flipped on its head.
Paint us a picture of who Bolsonaro is. I mean, is he really Brazil's Donald Trump?
He is Brazil's Donald Trump and more. So he's a former captain in the military under the dictatorship. He's been a congressional representative for the last 20 years on the far right. So his views are have been extremely conservative for a long, long time. But that's really garnering support at this moment with this kind of groundswell for nationalist and populist leaders around the world. So he is so controversial. He's been fined for his sexist, homophobic, and racist rhetoric. He's about to stand trial on the Supreme Court for comments, racist, homophobic comments. And he's come out and said that he would rather have his son dead than be gay. So that's just a picture of who this guy is and why he is so controversial and why he is so divisive.
Who are his supporters and are there many? I mean, is he a real contender in this presidential election?
He's not just a real contender. He's in second place after Lula. And when Lula is excluded from those polls, he's in the top position. According to the latest polls, he's around 22%, which might not sound like much. But in Brazil, there's two rounds. So many analysts that I've been listening to and reading lately say that he's a shoe-in to make it to the second round, particularly after this moment, because of how much support he might garner from people who might not otherwise have backed him, but now kind of a sympathy vote. So his supporters are obviously people on the far right. They're longtime conservatives, but they're also people that have seen the longtime corruption here in Brazil and have seen the economic crisis. And they've seen the insecurity, and they want someone who's going to come in and just wipe the slate clean.
When you talk to Bolsonaro's supporters, what do they say about him? Why do they like him?
They say he is the possibility of bringing in a new government, bringing change, bringing hope to a country that's got its back against the wall. And some of these people are really talking like this is the first time they're voting.
Eu confesso assim. Já votei faz muitos e muitos anos depois do regime militar, quando começou a ter eleições.
So there's one woman in particular who I interviewed just a week and a half ago, Lina Cristani. She's a 72-year-old grandmother from Porto Alegre, a retired teacher. What she's saying is that, to be honest, she feels like she's voting for the first time. So after the military dictatorship, when they started to have elections, you know, of course, she's always voted in all the elections. It's mandatory here in Brazil. But it seems like for her that she's voting for the first time. This is the first time she's able to choose a president that she really wants. Because the other times, those people didn't have the values that she did from the right. And she's very clear that she's conservative. But this is really the first time that she's voting. And she's super excited about casting her ballot for Bolsonaro.
From what you're saying, it sounds like the knife attack on Bolsonaro could bolster his stature among his supporters.
I think that's exactly what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what will happen in the coming days and coming weeks, but I think there's going to be sympathy for him. It's going to definitely solidify his support among those people who are most fervent. And I think there's a very large undecided number of people here in Brazil, particularly with what looks like Lula is going to be officially banned in just the coming days from being able to run the elections. Today is Independence Day, and Exactly one month out from the vote, and Brazilians are really just holding their breath and trying to get a sense of what's going to happen in the next couple of days here and the weeks before the vote.
Michael Fox is a journalist based in Brazil. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
quick note now on an event that takes place every year in Rwanda. The government there invites special guests to name the baby gorillas born in the country's mountains over the past 12 months. And the names are announced at a special ceremony that takes place in the foothills of Rwanda's Volcanoes National Park. This year's ceremony was held today before a crowd that numbered in the thousands. 23 baby mountain gorillas got their names from a group of celebrities and dignitaries. One of them was Nelson Mandela's widow, Graca Machel. She chose the name Urugori. That means crown in the local Kinyarwanda language.
I chose a name for my baby gorilla. And I give her the name of Urugori. Urugori means crown. It's how motherhood is celebrated in Rwanda.
The crown, she said, is a symbol of motherhood, a sign of respect to Rwandan women. A sheikh from the United Arab Emirates also got to name one of the baby gorillas. He chose the name Nyombi, which means exceptional care. And the U.S. ambassador to Rwanda, Peter Vrooman, came up with Intarutwa, or paramount. The naming ceremony was started by Rwandan tourism officials 13 years ago as a way to create awareness for the endangered primates. Fewer than 900 gorillas are believed to be left in the world. I'm Carol Hills. In his new book, journalist and Marine veteran C.J. Chivers profiles veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, including one Navy pilot who served in Afghanistan but was haunted by the bombs he dropped years before in Kosovo.
One of those bombs, he believes, may have hit a civilian home.
That story coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Defense Chief James Mattis popped up in Afghanistan today. The Trump administration is trying to restart peace talks with the Taliban. 17 years. That's how long the war in Afghanistan has been going on. Afghans still live with near daily violence, suicide bombings that kill indiscriminately. And the war has left its mark on the hundreds of thousands of Americans who went to fight there. Just this week, one of them was killed in an insider attack. C.J. Chivers' new book deals with that personal trauma. Chivers is a New York Times journalist and a former Marine. In his book, The Fighters, he tells the story of six combatants. One of them is Specialist Robert Soto, a soldier who initially impressed Chivers with his optimism.
A lot of us, if we put on uniforms, we look virtually alike. You tend almost to sometimes, you know, at 100 yards look like an insect horde. But at 100 yards, you would see Rob Soto's smile.
Wow.
It would light up the valley.
That's C.J. Chivers there. He dropped by our studios yesterday to talk with my colleague Marco Werman. Marco asked him to read the part of his book where he introduces Soto, an aspiring actor who joined the Army when he was 17.
He was nobody's archetype of a fighter. He had an enormous smile, which came to him almost unprompted. He liked to sing, and he sang often. His memory had at its command a vast repertoire of lyrics, R&B, rap, hip-hop, the blues, his personal collection of gems, which he would sing no matter what anyone else thought. Robbie Soto joined the Army upbeat, fast with that grin, the guy who made others feel good.
I was struck by your descriptions of Soto's patrols in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley that honestly kind of seem mindless, as if we painted a bullseye on a bunch of guys engaged in fights with the Taliban. How soon after arriving and being in these firefights did Soto start to have a different view of the war?
I'd say that Robbie went from idealist to realist inside of 6 weeks.
Wow.
Maybe 2 months.
Why? What happened?
He arrived
time?
In July, and by September, he lost his squad leader and one of the soldiers who had a previous tour in Iraq who he looked up to most, and a fellow new soldier. He could see that what they were doing wasn't going to work.
And who's they?
What the Army was doing, what NATO and the generals who had put the soldiers up in the valley at such a low level that they really could not affect the valley. And he concluded fairly quickly that they were there just because they were there. He couldn't find a strategic purpose. He couldn't draw a line. I mean, it's important when we talk about Robbie to realize that he was a young child when the World Trade Center was attacked.
Right.
and he wanted to protect New York City from another attack. And not long after joining the army and arriving in Korangal Valley, he could not draw a line to what the day-to-day life of his platoon was to making New York City safer.
Yeah, that point of view kind of hits me throughout the book, the extent to which these soldiers feel as these soldiers and these Marines feel as though their leaders are incompetent. Soto says of his superiors that they got him on the other side of the world on this mountain fighting these guys and they don't even know what they're doing. That's a big indictment.
That's a big indictment, and I would say it was fairly a common indictment. 8 years into this war, it was starting to feel, except for the purpose of surviving in each patrol, it was starting to feel for many of the people involved purposeless.
Tell us about Navy pilot Lieutenant Commander Lane McDowell and what has haunted him since 1999.
Lane is different than Rob in that he had joined before 9/11. He was a Naval Academy midshipman who excelled academically and athletically and found himself in flight school and became an F-14 pilot. And he had a lot of war experience before 2001, before the attacks on 9/11, including in Kosovo. And he was, as a lieutenant, very involved in the bombing in Kosovo for a few months. And one of those bombs, he believes, may have hit a civilian home. And he has been thinking about that for decades.
Could you read, actually, that part where he does talk about that?
He felt a chill. Have I killed a family? His analytical mind tallied factors. The intelligence had been poor. The imagery was bad. The tactics and ground fire had compressed his decision window. Drifting cloud deck had blocked his view. By his accounting, these were not acceptable excuses. Doubt had registered in his mind during the bomb's descent. He could have dragged the ordnance off target into a field. He had not done that. He was responsible for whatever had happened in that house. Up until now, I could say positively, while I have certainly killed Serb soldiers, I had not harmed a civilian. Now I don't know. It concerns me, partly because we were sent after a target impossible to see and the imagery was bad, but also that I allowed it to happen. I can only pray that God made sure no one was there. I can only hope there is no innocent blood on my hands.
And yet McDowell's superiors aren't worried about these possible civilian deaths, are they?
At that moment, they weren't especially worried. And Lane saw that moral gap. He actually wanted to be reprimanded or to have what he thought was likely a mishap examined so that its causes would be understood and so that maybe perhaps changes could be made. And that wasn't the attitude of his bosses. It was more like, we need to get back out and hit tomorrow's target list.
We pinged our veterans network asking about the psychological toll serving in Afghanistan and Iraq had taken on them. And we got to this from John Hudak, a former service member now in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
On my 11th deployment, as I was engaging an enemy combatant, I noticed that he was a man, a husband, a father, a brother. The psychic shift in seeing a target as so much more as actually a human shattered my ability to operate in combat areas. I retired shortly thereafter.
And we got this from a vet in our community.
Hi, my name's Mike from Pottstown, Pennsylvania. The psychic toll that the war in Afghanistan has taken on me is what makes me 100% disabled and unemployable. I can't figure out how to live in a way that makes up for it in order to heal. I no longer fit into American society.
And we got this from a service member in Irvine, California. I'm just getting out of bed, exhausted after another night of restless sleep and nightmares. It's this way most nights. For many years, I drank until the dreams wouldn't wake me or I wouldn't remember them. On top of that, I'm hypervigilant, uneasy in crowds, and easily startled. I'm just curious, Chris, among the lower ranks, how widespread is the view that higher-ups are disconnected from what really happens on the ground, and how much are they talking about this actively?
Many of the higher-ups now do have experience on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they certainly are alert to accounts like you just heard and what people have come home with. But I would also say that there is a feeling – I don't want to speak for all vets, but there is a prevalent feeling that the wars have been adrift for a very long time and that all of their tactical and personal efforts – all of the years poured into this by the rank and file weren't really connected to realistic ambitions or thoughtful strategy.
You've got this amazing quote opening the book, America is not at war. The Marine Corps is at war. America is at the mall. That was written inside the wall of a government center in Iraq.
In 2009, so almost a decade ago. Yeah. So this isn't a new sentiment, you know, about 3 million people who've been to the wars in uniform, which is less than 1% of the country. And I did feel a certain obligation to try to close that gap. So there's a lot of things that happen in this book that will make a reader uncomfortable, and there's a lot of moral gray.
Have you gotten any feedback from people at the Pentagon about the book?
Officially, no. Unofficially, every day. Many of those people aren't able to speak their feelings publicly. Some of them operate as insurgents within the system, and no small number of them are in touch with me, and they're very grateful that the rank and file's voices were channeled. They're grateful that the book tried to capture actual combat experiences and to show it as claustrophobically as it often really was, not with a great deal of strategic connection.
Honestly, I got anxious reading this book. It's not easy reading, but I doubt you wanted it to be easy. You're a vet yourself. I also know you have kids. Imagine one of them comes to you and says, you know, they're ready to enlist. What would you say?
So my kids. One of my sons is 18, will be graduating this year, and he has expressed an interest. He had expressed an interest in enlisting in the Marine Corps. And it's their decision. Each young person has to make the decision whether or not the military would potentially be something that they would serve for 4 years or for a career. But I would say that right now I do line up as a discouraging voice, having seen great human energy applied to unrealistic and sometimes senseless strategies.
Chris Chivers is the author of The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And an update on those two service members we mentioned in Chivers' book. Robert Soto now lives in New York and is a songwriter and rapper. As for Lieutenant Commander Lane McDowell, the Navy pilot haunted by his bombing missions in Kosovo, he remains on active duty in the Alaskan Command. Okay, we've just spent some time talking about men who went to fight in Afghanistan, but starting next week, we're going to hear about a different side of Afghanistan. The World's Shirin Jafari and Andrea Crossan recently went there to speak with Afghan women about their lives. And it wasn't just about violence and war. They also talked with designers and went to a fashion shoot. Shirin Jafari joins me in the studio. Shirin, you went to a photo shoot in Kabul.
Yeah, Carol, I visited a fashion studio at the heart of Kabul. It's run by a young Afghan woman called Rahiba Rahimi. She has this long, flowing, dark hair and has a really sweet smile. Rahimi is really breaking barriers in Afghanistan. She's one of an emerging group of female designers who are working hard to give women in Afghanistan more options when it comes to clothing. And the fashion scene is just one of the stories that I reported when I was in Afghanistan.
And I understand all the stories you did in Afghanistan are about women.
Well, I think often the stories coming out of war zones focus on men. We pay attention to the military generals, for example, the soldiers who are mostly men, the enemy, the Taliban, you know, the ones carrying the guns. But we tend to forget about the women. They're usually hidden, quiet, submissive. And I mean, one reason for that could be that in a conservative country like Afghanistan, it's very difficult to get women to let you into their lives and really open up about their problems, really talk about their hopes for the future. And so my producer, Andrea Carson, and I decided to set up an all-women team.
An all-women team in Kabul.
Yeah, there was me, Andrea, and two amazing Afghan ladies, photographer Farzana Wahidi and fixer Maryam Alimi. And we all set out to speak with as many Afghan women as we could.
Give me an example of the kind of women you spoke to.
Okay, so here's one. I sat down with Sahar Fatrat, a young up-and-coming filmmaker. She brought up this idea that I just talked about, that, you know, it's time to hand over the mic to Afghan women.
I think it's important to have female voices because I think the story of Afghan women is always that narrative of the victim, of the oppressed, of the one who doesn't probably understand or is not able. But I think what I want and my friends who are female journalists, what we want to do is to convey a different message and send a different message saying, you know, we are fighting. And this fight is important, and this process is important.
Wow. She sounds pretty determined.
Oh, absolutely. She's one unstoppable force.
I have to ask about security. I imagine it must have been tough to report in Kabul. I mean, it's known for being a very dangerous place. How did you manage that?
So we had to prepare a lot beforehand for this trip. As you know, there's been a lot of attacks recently in Afghanistan. Just this week, there were several suicide attacks, leaving several people dead, unfortunately.
Were you anywhere that the Taliban has traditionally targeted?
Yeah, so one place that we visited was the American University of Afghanistan. In 2016, the Taliban took over the university, and it was under siege for 9 hours. And so today, when you walk in, it's really more like a prison than a campus.
Okay, each one of us, when we register, we have to come to this room again and to do one more checkup.
On the right, we go for another check? Okay, all right.
And they're searching our bags again. It took me and my producer, Andrew Carson, about an hour to get through all these different security checks.
That's unbelievable. It's really great to have you two back. And everyone I talk to who goes to Afghanistan is really moved by it. Give us a sense of what it was like there, what it looked like, what it felt like to be there.
So the first thing I noticed as we drove out of the airport and into the city was that there were no red lights.
You mean traffic lights? No traffic lights at all?
No traffic lights, at least none that I saw. So that meant there were cars, people, bicycle, donkeys, all fighting for the right of way. And somehow, magically, everyone is able to get around each other and get to the place that they're supposed to be. But then you would see these signs that remind you that you are in a war zone. There are armored vehicles everywhere, checkpoints. We saw pickup trucks brimming with Afghan police forces. There are helicopters flying above. So you really can't escape the feeling that this city is on edge. But even with all that going on, people try their best to continue. They go to school, they start businesses, they make documentaries, and they try to make the best out of this difficult and challenging situation.
I'm really looking forward to hearing all your stories from Afghanistan, especially profiles of these younger women who are really kind of taking charge. It's a very interesting angle. The series, I know, begins on Monday here on The World. Thanks, Sharon.
You're welcome, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. It was just about 1 year ago that Hurricane Maria hit the island of Puerto Rico. In the aftermath, colleges and universities from New York to Florida wanted to do something to help. So they offered free or discounted tuition to students from Puerto Rico whose home institutions were closed. One of the first students to take them up on the offer was Rosa Marie Palerm. She enrolled at St. Thomas University in Miami in late September 2017 and moved into her new dorm room just a few days later.
Coming from no signal, no water, no light, sweating so much because of the humidity, coming here was like a big relief.
As part of our coverage of the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria, The World's Carolyn Beeler checked in with Palerm and some of her classmates.
When I interviewed Palerm in her Spartan Miami dorm room last fall, she already missed Puerto Rico and knew she wanted to go back.
Don't know when that is. Might be a year or 2 years, but I want to go back. I love my little island.
Turns out she didn't have to wait years, just 3 months. Her school in San Juan reopened in January, and the cheerful redhead decided to leave St. Thomas University.
Obviously, it was an opportunity, and I was very grateful for St. Thomas and everything they did. But as soon as I saw a window to come back home, I'm like, yes, I need my island, my family, my friends.
She left Miami the day after fall semester ended.
As soon as I got off the plane, I started crying. I was like, oh, finally, the heat, my island. I was so happy.
Palerm moved back in with her parents, brother, and two dachshunds, Lupe and Stella, who I met when I visited the family's modern black-and-white apartment in San Juan a few weeks ago. Palerm started classes at Sacred Heart University in San Juan last winter as the campus was rebuilt around her. It's still being repaired now.
You see a lot of construction, like they're fixing a lot of areas of the university, making it better. The light would go on and off. They would sometimes cut the water because they were fixing something. So it's always something getting fixed, getting better.
The same could be said for her neighborhood, which is a few blocks from the beach in a trendy part of San Juan. Palerm takes me to her favorite park.
I used to come here to read because there were a lot of trees, so there was a lot of shade.
Many of the trees died during the hurricane, leaving the park exposed to the sun.
But it's cool to see it slowly coming back.
On a busy commercial street, there are empty storefronts with for lease signs in the windows.
All these places left after the hurricane, that's why it's for lease.
But Palerme spots a brand new restaurant among them.
This used to be also for lease. Like, this is, I haven't seen this. This is new.
Another sign of recovery in the neighborhood, the red, white, and blue Puerto Rican flags fluttering everywhere you look.
Puerto Rico se levanta. We're rising again. That's what everybody keeps saying after the hurricane.
After Hurricane Maria, dozens of private schools and state college and university systems in Florida, New York, and Connecticut gave tuition breaks to Puerto Rican students. Demographers warned this could help add to Puerto Rico's exodus, hurting the odds that the island would rise again. Some tuition discounts ended last spring, but many still continue, including at St. Thomas University. More than half of last year's students are staying on, including Luis Aviles. He has a much less optimistic view of Puerto Rico than Palerme does.
I went back only for 2 weeks on the summer, and the things in Puerto Rico, they're not good.
While he was home, his car got stolen.
And that's when I said, you know what, I'm not going to stay here. Like, I don't feel safe in the island, and my family, everybody's like, if you're making it better for you, just stay. That's why I'm staying over here.
Aviles is a sophomore studying business, and even with the discounts he's getting, he still expects to pay twice as much for school here as he would in Puerto Rico. He works up to 60 hours a week as a mechanic to help pay his tuition.
I have to work harder. I'll work harder. I will. But I know at the end, it's all going to be worth it.
Estimates of how many Puerto Ricans left the island after Hurricane Maria vary widely, between 200 and 400,000. There's no count of how many students who transferred to schools on the mainland have stayed. But it's clear Aviles isn't the only one. Victoria Angulo graduated from St. Thomas with a psychology degree last December.
And then I went to Puerto Rico for about 3 weeks. The opportunities there in jobs, there weren't much.
So Angulo came back and is now teaching at a Catholic school in Miami. She says her semester in Florida improved her English and taught her some key professional skills that landed her the job.
Thanks to St. Thomas, I have what I have right now. The job that I have, the experience, if it wasn't because of Hurricane Maria, I wouldn't have had it.
Back in San Juan, Rosa Marie Palerme will finish college in December and plans to go to med school. She says the hurricane has taught her to be more flexible.
Because now if I decide, but I'm going to med school, so I'm like, okay, so if this happens, like another hurricane, what's my plan B? Like, I have to strategize what I'm going to do. So now it's like plan A, B, C, D.
But her end game is just the same as it was a year ago when I spoke to her in her very temporary dorm room in Miami. Help Puerto Rico rise again.
After I graduate, I want to work here. I want to stay. I want to raise my family if I ever get that opportunity here. Yeah, anything to help the economy, the people. I love my home. Then I want to see it get better, not worse.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Here's hoping things do keep getting better for Puerto Rico and not worse. And now let's head into the weekend on an upbeat note, literally, thanks to New York-based DJ Nicodemus. Is called Caballito del Mar, which means seahorse in Spanish, and it features Argentine singer Layegros on vocals. She sings about waking up on the sand, going into the ocean, and then finding a seahorse to guide her away from everything, far away from her problems. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in and have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.